This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Here in the U.S., June is known as Gay and Lesbian Pride Month, recognizing the contributions and concerns of LGBT people in this country. Later, we'll talk with two people on the cutting edge of what's become one of the markers of LGBT progress. They are the authors of a new book about how to photograph same-sex weddings. There are some interesting similarities and differences that might surprise you. But first, speaking of weddings, here's a clip from a recent episode of Saturday Night Live.
That's why I use Xanax for gay summer weddings.
Because your gay friends have it all figured out, and you don't.
At my wedding, we gave guests Cheez-Its and a mini bottle of water. Keith and William gave us 2 tickets to Italy and $40,000.
And if you saw this skit, then you know it's playing off what seems to be the widely held idea that gay couples are better off than most couples. Now, though, there's a new study from the Williams Institute that shows that poverty rates are actually higher for same-sex couples than for straight couples. We wanted to hear more about that, so we've called Professor Lee Badgett. She's the research director at the Williams Institute. That's a research institute at UCLA Law School that focuses on LGBT issues. She's also an economics professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and she's with us now from member station New England Public Radio. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So is the overall picture here that same-sex couples are more likely to be poorer than straight couples?
Yes, we do see that same-sex couples are much more likely to be poor. And even when we look at people who are not in same-sex couples, we have some data on lesbian, gay, and bisexual individuals. We also see that they're more likely to be poor.
But let's focus on couples, though, because I think it's understood that marriage, being a couple, is often kind of a bulwark against poverty, right? Or a hedge against poverty because you have two incomes to draw on when sort of times get tough. Are there certain same-sex couples that are more likely to be poor, for example? Are lesbians more likely to be poor than men? Are African-Americans more likely to be poor than white couples?
We definitely see some subgroups who are more likely to be poor, and you hit on two of them. Lesbian couples in particular are combining two women's incomes instead of a man and a woman's income, and that means that they will just have lower than average incomes in general. So they are more likely to be poor. We do see that African-Americans are more likely to be poor than our married different-sex African-American couples, but they're also more likely to be poor than white same-sex couples, so they seem to get a double whammy.
What about white gay male couples?
They seem to be doing pretty well when you just look at their overall poverty rate. So we wanted to dig a little bit deeper, and we compared white gay men and African-American gay male couples, all the different kinds of couples, and tried to hold constant or to take into account all the things that influence people's poverty rates. So they have higher levels of education. They're less likely to have kids. Those are things that tend to protect people from poverty. But once we were comparing apples to apples, we found that the gay male couples are more likely to be poor.
Any idea why that is?
There are a couple of possibilities. One that I think you have to think hard about is the fact that there is likely to be discrimination in the workplace against lesbian, gay, and bisexual people. And discrimination usually goes along with lower earnings. And we do see that for gay and bisexual men in particular in the labor force. It also comes with a higher likelihood of losing your job, and that's a big predictor of poverty. So I think that's likely to be one of the biggest factors driving these differences.
Why don't we wheel it around, though? Just referencing that Saturday Night Live skit. I mean, part of the reason that it's funny is that people think it's true, right? So why is there this image of LGBT couples being not just okay, but really well off?
Well, that clip that you played was one great example about why. In the media, those are the people that you see. Those are the gay and lesbian people you see. They have good jobs. They have nice homes. There have, over the last couple of decades, been other people pushing this image. People who oppose civil rights laws for gay and lesbian people often will point to that image and say, hey, you know, gay people aren't a real minority. They're doing really well. And even in the gay community itself, sometimes there are people who point to that image to say, hey, we're a great marketing niche. You should have your company target our population. So there are lots of different people trying to promote that image, both intentionally and unintentionally.
You think part of it is that the people who tend to be most visible, at least on the, maybe let's just say in the forward flanks, right, of the gay community in terms of people who are visible, they tend to be what? Artists or people who are very successful business people. Is that
exactly. it? Yeah. Big actors, big name actors, the Neil Patrick Harris, you know, who was just on the Tonys last night. I mean, if that's your image, if you don't know any other gay or lesbian people and you're thinking, who pops into my head when I think of that term, it's likely to be those people who are out in front of the media, or Tammy Baldwin in the Senate, you know, people who look powerful and who look like they're doing pretty well for themselves. And they are, but they're just not typical of the whole gay and lesbian population.
That's what I wanted to ask you. So why do you think this new information matters? Why do you think it's important to pay attention to? Because there's a lot of talk now about, you know, the whole question of positive stereotypes versus negative stereotypes. Some people feel that positive stereotypes aren't so bad because if it causes people to look at you with a little bit more respect, maybe, than they would otherwise, what's so terrible? So why do you think this information is important?
Well, stereotypes definitely can cut both ways. And I think in this case, what looks like a positive stereotype can really hold back a discussion about public policy, about the fact that we don't have any kind of federal protections against discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. And I think that's one place where this stereotype gets in the way of an important discussion. And then, you know, we're still grappling with issues around poverty and, you know, where there's a big debate about funding for food stamps, for instance. And that, I think, what we see in this report is that that's a gay issue too, just like employment discrimination. So our hope is that when people in the gay community are thinking about poverty issues, they're thinking, yeah, this is important for us too. And when people in the poverty world are thinking, you know, who are our clients, that they're also recognizing that they have same-sex couples and gay and lesbian people and bisexual people and transgender people in their clientele, and they're trying to make sure that their services are welcoming to those folks as well.
That was Lee Badgett. She is the research director at the Williams Institute, and she's also economics professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Professor Badgett, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
It's not exactly a buyer's market for people who purchase their own health insurance. Prices can be high and options severely limited. A key piece of the Affordable Care Act is supposed to change that. New health exchanges will allow people to comparison shop for insurance, maybe even get a subsidy to help pay for it. But as New Hampshire Public Radio's Todd Bookman reports, some people may still be left with few choices.
John Lynch recently celebrated his 26th birthday. His present? Getting kicked off his mom's health insurance plan.
If I was like a healthy 26-year-old who, you know, thinks they're invincible or whatever, it's fine, but like I'm not in that position. I need to get medication because I have like a long-term condition.
That condition is asthma. Lynch, who also just finished a degree in English at the University of New Hampshire, uses both an emergency inhaler and a daily medicine. He can't afford the prescriptions and is biding his time until October. That's when the new exchanges go live and the tax subsidies meant to make coverage affordable become available. The mandate that all Americans have insurance kicks in January 1st.
And so, for better or for worse, I'm tied up with the exchange. I'm at the mercy of the exchange.
So are an estimated 7 million other individuals and small business employers expected to take part in exchanges nationwide. There's been concern that in some markets, they won't have many options to choose from. The Obama administration is trying to put that talk to rest. In a memo, it said more than 120 companies have applied to sell plans, and nearly 90% of shoppers will have more than five insurance companies to choose between. The picture, though, looks very different in some states. Rhode Island, three insurers are participating. Vermont, just two. And in New Hampshire, the concern is that Granite Staters will have just one company to buy from.
Listen, when you have states that have very limited numbers of carriers dominating the market, this is not a significant change.
Linda Blumberg is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. She says many states are like New Hampshire, where one company, Anthem Blue Cross, sells more than 80% of the plans. When the exchange opens, they could get all that business too, in effect, a monopoly. But Lisa Girton, president of Anthem, claims that even if other insurers did enter the market, that alone wouldn't push premiums down.
The price of health insurance on or off the exchange is a direct reflection of the underlying cost of care.
Girton says the cost of care isn't set by insurers, it's set by providers, by doctors and hospitals. The deputy commissioner at the New Hampshire Insurance Department agrees. Alex Fellwebel argues that because providers drive price, insurance company monopolies can actually be good things.
The way it works out is that competition in the insurance market doesn't necessarily help the consumer in terms of lower prices for insurance.
The reason for this, according to Feldwebel, is that what you're buying with health insurance isn't just access to health care. What you're getting is a negotiator. Companies like Anthem can walk into contract talks with more leverage. They say to a hospital, we can bring you this many bodies if you give us a good deal on their care.
And what does an insurance carrier need to get a good discount? It needs to be big and have a lot of covered lives.
So if big insurance companies get even bigger by cleaning up in the exchange, Feldwebel believes that prices could actually go down. But he still says that in the long run, more competition will be better for consumers, people like 26-year-old John Lynch. When he goes to shop in October, he wants choices.
And so if the exchange doesn't do anything to foster that, what's the point?
And while skeptics of the health overhaul law will likely be asking that same question, for people with no insurance or who have been denied due to pre-existing conditions, they may be willing to trade less competition for more coverage. For NPR News, I'm Todd Bookman in Concord, New Hampshire.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Ever since national leaders of the Boy Scouts of America voted to change their rules to allow openly gay youth to participate in scouting, the response has been intense. The Southern Baptist Convention, which lobbied against including gay scouts, starts its annual meeting in Houston today. As NPR's Kathy Lohr reports, some churches have already decided to end their affiliation with the 103-year-old scouting movement.
In Marietta, Georgia, pastor of Roswell Street Baptist Church, Dr. Ernest Easley, recently preached about the Book of Nehemiah. He told his members that the story is about people who promised to dedicate themselves to God's laws, but failed to follow through.
And it all started with one step of compromise away from the Word of God. They compromised in their leadership, their stewardship, and yes, even in their relationship.
This church has been affiliated with the Boy Scouts since 1945.
It's sad, and yet it's a simple decision for us.
Pastor Easley says the church will end its longtime sponsorship of Boy Scout Troop 204.
For us, it would be a compromise of God's word, and I cannot imagine the membership of our church wanting us to violate the very principles that we live in what we believe by.
Another pastor in the Atlanta area, Reverend Bryant Wright with Johnson Ferry Baptist, said in a video statement that his church will also discontinue its association with scouting.
We didn't pick this controversy, and we're deeply saddened by it. But we cannot compromise what God has called us to do in obedience to Him.
Both churches are affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention, a network of more than 45,000 churches that lobbied to keep gay members out of scouting. Convention spokesman Roger Oldham says there's still time for affiliates to figure out how they want to proceed.
They can begin to make other plans, sort of slowly coming to a stop and then making that decision to divest themselves of that relationship and perhaps looking for other organizations they would step into to continue providing the same kind of character development that the Boy Scouts has provided.
At the Southern Baptist Convention's annual meeting this week, a resolution on whether churches should continue to support troops is likely to come up. About 70% of troops are sponsored by religious organizations. Kent Barnett is with the members of Churches of Christ for Scouting. His members sponsor more than 500 Boy Scout units involving 15,000 youth.
And many are asking, is there an alternative?
Barnett says he's received dozens of phone calls, emails, and text messages from parents asking about a new boys group that's in the planning stages.
They're fed up with the Boy Scouts of America, and they feel the next step will be allowing homosexual leaders to end scouting.
Efforts to start a new group were announced in Texas just after Boy Scout leaders voted. Here's John Stemberger with the Florida Family Policy Council.
We will host and facilitate a national coalition meeting of former Boy Scout parents and other youth leaders who wish to return to the truly timeless values that once made the Boy Scouts of America great.
The group has started a website called faithbasedboys.org. Some parents say it may pattern itself after American Heritage Girls, a Christian group based in Cincinnati. That group was formed by disgruntled Girl Scout parents in the 1990s and claims more than 20,000 members. The Boy Scouts did not respond to a request for comment on this new group or on the churches that say they're dropping out. While some are troubled by the Scouts' new policy, others continue to encourage participation. Bishop David Chobe is with the Diocese of Nashville, which includes 54 parishes.
As of this moment, you know, I'm comfortable with seeing that the program continues in our parishes.
He says he's confident that scouting will not allow sexual activity of any kind, but will remain focused on building confidence and leadership skills.
It's brought into their lives a sense of direction, a sense of responsibility, and their ability to give their gifts, you know, back to society.
Every diocese will issue its own response. In a statement, the National Catholic Committee on Scouting said people who experience a homosexual inclination are to be treated with respect, and the committee said there's time to study the effects of the policy before it takes effect in January. Later this month, those trying to form their own Christian boys group plan to meet in Louisville. Kathy Lohr, NPR News.
Now to another topic in tech. Today, Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference launched in San Francisco. The company made a slew of announcements: new MacBooks, a new operating system, and the most anticipated announcement, Apple's entry into the streaming music market with iTunes Radio. But as NPR's Laura Seidel reports, many analysts are underwhelmed.
The hype around Apple getting into the internet radio biz was so intense that it sent rival Pandora's stock plunging. But when Apple's Eddie Q finally made the announcement at today's conference, it took less than 4 minutes of a two-hour event.
Today, we're introducing an amazing way to discover new music, and we call it iTunes Radio.
Q showed off features that will be familiar to anyone who listens to the variety of music streaming services already on the market. It lets you create your own stations based on an artist or song you like, kind of like Pandora.
And a great thing is I can always modify the station. I can just tap the star, and I can say, play more songs like this, or never play this song, or add it to my wish list. Now, I like this, so let's play some more songs like this.
Of course, the Apple advantage is that the new service makes it really easy to tap a button and buy a track from the iTunes store. Its success had everyone thinking Apple was going to upend the music business again. iTunes is the number one music retailer, and it moved the industry from fighting non-paying customers who downloaded songs to making money from selling song files. But James McQuivey, an analyst with Forrester Research, thinks the big labels are not grateful to Apple for making it easier for people to buy individual tracks.
It forced them to make changes they didn't want to make. The music industry didn't want to change its model. The model they had was very, very comfortable for them.
The model they had was the CD and the album. McQuivey thinks Apple may actually be paying more than other services like Pandora, Spotify, or Slack or Radio to stream music.
The music labels don't only want Apple to pay for this new product. They want Apple to pay, almost as it were, a pound of flesh for the last 10 years.
Apple follows Google into the streaming music market, though Apple's service is ad-supported and Google charges $10 a month. McQuivey thinks Apple had to get into the streaming music business, whether it's profitable or not. He says music isn't a product, it's part of a service.
And in those music services, you see the future of music, which is people use music to sell other things. They use music to get people's attention for other things. That's why credit card companies sponsor Beyoncé.
McQuivey says it's not about the music anymore, but so many people are passionate about music that more streaming music services just keep popping up. But so far, none of them are making investors very happy. Laura Seigel, NPR News, San Francisco.